Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, we are right with Michael Schumacher now. And Senna, my goodness, I just saw him plunge off to the right. And Senna has joined Pietro Lamy and JJ Leto in a shattered motor car. You can see the debris on the right. What on earth happened there? I don't know whether it was a sudden loss of downforce for some reason. But Senna is still in the car.
Well, we don't know the circumstances of Senna's accident at this point, but certainly when Berger went off, he hit the wall very, very hard. I think, in fact, it was maybe a little earlier in the corner, but nonetheless, this Tamburello corner, it is flat out. There are those retaining walls, but they're hard, they are concrete, and you saw how unyielding the impact was. But the car bounced off, and a lot of energy was dissipated in the first contact. But again, Professor Watkins and the medical team here in San Marino working on Senna, trying to stabilize. We saw movement from his head, so that's a very positive indication. But yet again, really, and I've never been to a Grand Prix as a competitor or in a role as a commentator where I've seen so much. I don't know, I'm just running a lot of words. Michael Schumacher out of the car. His car stopped on the start-finish line. And this really most sad and dramatic weekend for Formula One.
Yeah, it certainly was. We are exactly 25 years on from that day, May 1st, 1994. The seventh lap of the San Marino Grand Prix, Ayrton Senna, still only 34 years of age, three-time world champion at the time, crashing into the Tamburello corner and dying instantly. He's an iconic figure and probably now remembered by more people than ever after the truly stunning 2010 film Senna, which is must-see if you haven't seen it. It's just an extraordinary piece of work. We're joined there by one of the men you heard on commentary duty, John Watson, Formula One driver between 73 and 85. He won five Grand Prix, he finished third in the 1982 championship, and he was there alongside Murray Walker trying to digest incredibly distressing scenes. And I suspect, John, judging by your tone at the time, and it's good to talk to you again, great to have you back on the show, I suspect fully realizing just how serious this whole thing looked.
Well, good evening, Joe. Well, first of all, it was an awful weekend. It started badly. Rubens Barrichello had an accident that could have been fatal in Eddie Jordan's team. Then we lost Roland Ratzenberger on the Saturday qualifying, which was sent a real shockwave through the paddock, and not least of all Senna, who was very upset indeed, and talked a great deal to Professor Watkins, the Formula One medical delegate, who in fact was in attendance with Senna himself, and he'd had his accident. Everything on the weekend, I don't know how to express it, even 25 years down the road. It was just one of those weekends. I've never had an experience like it, and I hope never to see it again at any Grand Prix.
It was utterly tragic. You mentioned the Barrichello accident on the Friday and then Ratzenberger's death on the Saturday. That was, I was looking back, the first death in over 180 Grand Prix, Ratzenberger's. We know how dangerous the sport especially was, and still is to a point, but especially was. Was the sense and the mood at the time that actually this Grand Prix should be cancelled? Because over 180 Grand Prix since the previous fatality, this was still very, very far from humdrum or normal.
Well, I think that the likelihood of a Grand Prix being cancelled is pretty unlikely. I mean, to be was rather blunt about it, when there's a serious accident, in the case of Roland Ratzenberger, it is very unusual to have a death announced in the circuit. Normally what happens is that the injured party is, first of all, stabilized as best the medics can do, then transferred either to the medical center within the circuit or alternatively flown directly to the nearest hospital. And there are a number of hospitals in the location that are on alert for, depending on the kind of injuries that might need treatment. So the likelihood of a Grand Prix being canceled is basically unlikely. It's a function of European law, of law in certain Latin countries, that wherein if there is a fatality at a sporting event, then in effect the police take control of the event and the event is effectively banned or is abandoned.
John, am I right in saying it's still not entirely clear what the cause of the issue of Senna's death was in terms of like the mistake, what went wrong with the car, what exactly happened?
Well, at the point of the incident, when I was doing commentary, I think I was said on air that, in my view, that this accident was not something caused by the driver. In other words, the driver was not responsible for the car leaving the track at such high speed and then having the contact with their retaining wall on the outside. And I've been looking through a variety of material that's available on the web, and a number of other drivers, contemporaries of Ayrton and maybe some of my contemporaries, are all by and large of a view that there was a mechanical issue that led the car to go off track. I have never said that per se. All I have said is, and I believe this to this day, that Senna was a passenger in effect from the point of in the corner. He was near the exit of Tamburello, and Tamburello was a very, very long but very high-speed corner. And one of the notable points of the corner at this particular Grand Prix, where there were three separate bits of new track had been laid, you could see them. There were dark tarmac, and dark tarmac. And on the previous lap, going through this corner at 190 miles an hour, the rear of Senna's car clearly bottomed because you could see sparks coming from it. On the following lap in which he then had the accident, again, there was a degree of sparking from the rear of the car, but not as bad as the previous lap. But then the car appeared to veer off to the right. In effect, what it had done, it had stopped taking the corner, and it was going more or less straight. Mm. And that was the view that we had from Michael Schumacher's car, from the onboard camera on Michael Schumacher's car. But that camera then shut down, you know, literally at the point where the Williams, which is Senna's car, started to veer away. Then that camera either was shut down, or the director of the thing, he chose to offer up different pictures. And the next picture we saw was Senna's car basically in contact with the wall and then sliding all the way down the main straight and coming to a rest, you know, a couple of hundred yards from the point of impact.
Lots of people are fascinated by Senna, and the reason is twofold. There is his personality, which we'll come to in a moment, and then what he brought to the sport as a driver. So Senna, three-time world champion, 161 Grand Prix starts. He was on pole 65 times, which is extraordinary. 41 wins. They're the numbers. Can you take us behind those and talk to us about the Ayrton Senna you knew as a driver?
I mean, Ayrton was a very unique person. Forget about being a racing driver. But in terms of what he was doing in a racing car, and I mean, I only raced against him in one Grand Prix, and that was Brands Hatch 1985. I saw something which I'd never, ever in my life seen prior, and I probably haven't even seen since. And that was a level of commitment from a driver on a qualifying lap at a point when racing cars were very much more manually controlled than they are, for example, in contemporary Formula One. So there was a regular gear stick, normal clutch, brake, and throttle. Everything was controlled by the driver. There were no paddle shifts. There were no hydraulics in the car. Very, very much a mechanical race car. And Senna was probably the first driver who I had heard, because I was hearing this from my car. He was changing gear, going down the gears, blipping the throttle, turning the steering wheel to go into the next corner. And he was left foot braking, which I'd never known anybody in Formula One to do. He was keeping the throttle, the engine spinning to try and keep the boost pressure in the turbocharged motor, which is what we were racing at these times, keep the boost pressure up so that when he got back on the throttle, he was going to have more horsepower than if he had been lifting off the throttle completely. And it was just having the mental capacity to do all these things simultaneously, and at the pace he was going, the car was literally, it was like a stone skimming across water. It was just dancing across the racetrack. And it was carrying so much speed. And I went, can I believe what I've just witnessed? Can I believe what I've just heard? Because I had never, ever seen a racing driver commit and carry so much speed in a difficult part of Brands Hatch, which is where we were racing, and continue on and finish the lap and do a lap which was way, way quicker than anybody else had achieved in qualifying. In fact, I remember walking past the team principal and the technical director in the team and said, wow, Senna was on that lap, I can tell you. And they turned right and said, yeah, wasn't he? It was just a 3 or 4 second glimpse of an utter genius behind the wheel, but doing something at a magnitude beyond anybody that I'd raced against, or maybe probably more than anybody has ever been a racing driver.
John, I think that's one of the most interesting answers we've ever had in the show, I have to say. That sounds absolutely amazing. And his peers recognised that, did they? They all knew they were in the presence of something different.
Well, they were all obviously competitors. And, I mean, the thing that Ayrton did was that he wanted to emphasise that commitment. So he didn't really take too many prisoners on the racetrack.
Yeah.
And sometimes off the racetrack, likewise. That's all part of the game. But what he had was this incredible ability to just drive a racing car quicker than anybody, either his teammate or in a competitive team. Now, because in Formula One, you make your own team, you make your own cars, so everybody was racing in those days in their McLarens, as Senna was, or as Nigel Mansell was in a Williams, or Gerhard Berger might have been in a Ferrari, or whatever it happened to be. So that there are technical differences between the cars. The thing that brings it all together is the human being, is the interaction between the driver, the engineers, the tire companies, to maximize performance that's available with the package that you've got. But when you're a driver at the level and the capacity of Ayrton Senna, you're the driver that every team in the paddock wants, because they want the best or the quickest driver. And at any given time, it's arguable that Ayrton was both the best and the quickest. Now, other drivers may not quite concur. I mean, Alain Prost was Senna's teammate for 2 years, and they went toe-to-toe, head-to-head. I mean, literally, they were biting lumps out of each other. It was almost ugly at some points because the rivalry became so intense. Mm. And both drivers were actually guilty of being a little bit naughty to one another on the racetrack.
Well, there's no doubt, and the Senna documentary really captures that rivalry in particular. And you know, they ran each other off the track in consecutive years. 89, initially it was Senna, the victim, and then he went for Prost in 1990 in Japan.
And it was ugly,
yeah,
basically.
For sure.
What Prost did was a little bit more subtle. What Senna did in Japan was, it was a guided missile, literally. I mean,
160 kilometers an hour.
I spoke to Alan Prost about what occurred the following day, because we were traveling on the same aircraft. And I said, why did you not just shut the door going into turn one in Japan?
Mm.
Because you'd have blocked Senna coming down the inside. You'd have forced him to take the long way around. He said, John, whatever I was going to do, he was going to take me out.
Yeah.
And that was Prost's view. That was his belief.
Yeah.
It was ugly. It was a part of motor racing that there is no place for. And if that were to happen today, the driver that would be responsible would be in a much, much more, I would say, serious situation in relation to his long-term ability to retain his driving license.
Gerhard Berger, in a documentary I saw, not the Senna one, but a different one I was watching today, said that he felt it was Senna's mentality that was the difference, his bravery. Now, I hadn't heard anyone in that same documentary talk about his technique the way you've explained in such fascinating detail. But equally, Prost did say, he said of himself, Prost, that he was 99% committed to being a racing driver, especially when he was in the car, but that there was just still 1%, I guess, an element of self-preservation for your family and for your friends that you just couldn't quite relinquish. So he said he was 99% committed, but he felt that Senna was 110% committed when it came to bravery in a car. Does that tally with your sense?
Well, I think certainly, I used the word commitment. He used the word commitment. He fulfilled it in every sense of what the word would be. But you see, the difference is that you don't need always, and I think this is one of the areas that's a subject of discussion. I mean, even in contemporary times, we see one or two drivers who seem to have the need to be always quickest, historically, with similar situations. But to win a motor race, to win a Grand Prix, and to win a world championship, it isn't just simply about always being the quickest guy at every session, at every Grand Prix. There are other factors that come into how you win a Grand Prix. And Alain Prost was exceptionally gifted at understanding how to win a Grand Prix. And one of the things that Alain did in winning many of the Grand Prix that he and the World Championships is that he was, in a say, the antithesis of what Ayrton was. He was like an artist in the way that he drove his race car. He painted the race, whereas Senna sort of threw the paint at the canvas. It was a different approach, and both achieved, you know, effectively their aspirations. But when you had them together, you two massive talents exemplified in different forms in the same team with the same equipment. Now, I know that for Alain, for example, he felt at some points that maybe in terms of the engine that they were both using Honda engines at this time, that because Senna was very, very highly regarded in Japan and kind of sort of the Senna mentality fitted into the Japanese, maybe samurai mentality, you know, courage, bravery, commitment, Alain felt that maybe the better engine, if there was a choice, was going to Senna and not to Alain. And that Alain got quite, you know, I wouldn't say bitter and twisted about it, but he began to get maybe paranoid about it.
But it wasn't that a feature of racing, especially at the time? Like, even in the year of Senna's death, he was looking over at Michael Schumacher's Benetton and he was deeply suspicious of electronic aids. And that was a shadow under which he raced in his final year.
Well, yes, that was true. And I think that, I'm familiar with many of the people that were working at Benetton at that particular time. But what was, I think the counterpoint to that was when Senna left McLaren at the end of 93 and joined Williams. Williams had dominated the 93 championship. Alain Prost became the world champion because they had by far and away the most successful and probably the most sophisticated Formula One car of all times. But with the regulation change coming in 1994, the active suspension, amongst other issues, was banned. And Williams, the car that they produced for 1994 season, was a mere shadow of the former 1993 car. And Senna was, I think, disappointed, to say the least, in that all of a sudden he realized that a car I thought was going to give me a relatively straightforward run at the championship was by no means at a competitive level. And he was having to dig very, very deep in his own, you know, reserves in terms of what he was prepared to do. And I believe at the point when he went to Williams, he was possibly beginning to think further down the road. And ultimately, that further down the road would have involved a life beyond being a Formula One race driver or a Formula One world champion. He was looking for an easier route to win a world championship at Williams. So he was having to do things in qualifying in particular to get that car to the front of the grid. And there were suggestions, rumors, whatever, that Benetton had maybe got mechanisms embedded within the electronics of the car that by pushing this button, that button, and 100 other buttons, you could activate. And to some degree, I think that was confirmed. But at the point when Senna and Schumacher were racing in the first three Grand Prix, nothing was ever established. And, it's moved forward. We don't know any further about it now.
Yeah.
Well, there were a number of issues in the 94 season that were not, for Senna, what I would describe as how he would have wished them to be.
No, I wouldn't think so. He was 34 when he passed away, and even in that lesser car, he got that car on the pole three times over the initial stages of the championship. His teammate Damon Hill, who we know all about, he was 0.922 seconds ahead of him in qualifying sessions, which is quite something. So he was getting a lot out of the car. That is the driving side of things. As for the personality, I mean, I think I, like a lot of people, I was too young to remember Senna, really, certainly as a person. And I watched the documentary in 2010, like so many, and was just blown away by his personality. I found him utterly compelling and complex. And he looked like a movie star, and he's a philosopher, and he's a bit tortured. And there was just this incredible charisma about him and an eloquence about him, even in his second language. And, you know, he was saying things like, "You're doing something that nobody else is able to do." This is when he was talking about being the fastest driver in the world. "You're doing something that nobody else is able to do. But at the very same moment that you're seen as the best, the fastest, and somebody that can't be touched, you're enormously fragile because in a split second it's gone. These two extremes are feelings that you don't get every day. These are all things which contribute to, how can I say, knowing yourself deeper and deeper. these are the things that keep me going. That gives a sense.
I think you've summed that up extremely eloquently and very accurately. I mean, Ayrton came from Brazil. He came from a very comfortable family background. He was an intelligent man. He was educated, sophisticated, very proud of being Brazilian, even more proud of being a Paulista from São Paulo. What was the ultimate, or what was it that maybe through his childhood and his upbringing created this laser-like commitment to want to be a world champion? And he started, like many others, in karting in Brazil. He then came over to Britain and raced in junior formula, got slightly disillusioned, went back home, got married, got divorced, came back again, regrouped. And really, I mean, I met him first, I think it was 1981 or 82, at a Formula Ford 2000 event in Denmark, because through our mutual sponsors, I was taken over to be there for promotional reasons. And this was a young guy, and you could sense his self-belief and confidence. And, I mean, I could imagine him looking at me, and he was introduced through a third party who was a friend, and I could imagine that in the back of his mind, it said, who's this silly old guy? I could blow him away if I had a chance on a Formula One car.
Yeah.
Now, most youngsters, that's what they think. They look at the establishment. You can see it with people like Max Verstappen looking at the established drivers, Lewis Hamilton and Sebastian Vettel. You've now got Charles Leclerc coming in. We are just cannon fodder for these youngsters, and Senna would have had that in spades.
Did he strike you as tortured?
I don't think he was tortured in the literal sense, but I think that there were complexities within his personality. Away from a racetrack and in a normal, I would call, domestic situation, he was a very different person to the person who one would meet or have to contend with on a racetrack.
Yeah, could you expand on that, John?
He enjoyed going back to Brazil. I know that he had close friends, and he established himself for part of his life in Portugal. And he had one particular, an elderly gentleman who was like a counsel to him, who he would seek maybe wisdom from or advice from. He wouldn't necessarily associate an awful lot with his peers. I mean, Gerhard Berger, as his teammate for 2 years, was probably the one teammate with whom he actually sort of opened up a little bit more, rather than being this sort of clam-like at times, maybe introverted personality.
Mm.
Gerhard Berger, who is, again, the antithesis of what Ayrton was. I mean, I tell you, I could spend an evening telling you about Gerhard Berger. But at least he helped Ayrton evolve and develop maybe a little bit in another element of being a man and enjoying life.
Mm. So how was he different, potentially, if you met him in the pit lane versus in a social setting away from that pressure?
Well, in the pit lane, he was there to do his job, and the job he was there to do was to win the Grand Prix and get maximum points and go on and ultimately win a world championship. Whereas I was fortunate to meet him on a number of occasions through mutual friends who lived in Stuttgart in Germany, which is where Mercedes-Benz is based, and Hugo Boss is based just outside Stuttgart. So we would both be visiting Stuttgart, and we'd be staying with mutual friends. So we had the opportunity to have dinner away from a racetrack, to just talk about the things that you would normally talk about when you go out for dinner. You might be talking about clothes or movies or food or wine or maybe the next car you're going to buy, or what did you get at Hugo Boss today? Or I didn't see that. Whereabouts was that in the store?
Mm.
Normal things that people who go out for dinner would talk about.
Yeah. As we wrap this up, in terms of his legacy, obviously his death and the nature of his death is one legacy, given that it's the last one in Formula One, and the safety measures which were implemented afterwards can't be overstated. What about his popularity and what he did for the sport? And like, did you see this, for instance, the Senna documentary? I've referenced it a few times now. Did you watch that? Did you enjoy that? Did you think that was good? Like, Senna now is as famous as he's ever been.
Well, I think, there was a very interesting documentary. I mean, it was obviously very much a Senna documentary.
Yeah.
I mean, just very recently, Alain Prost says he can't bear to watch it because that's a one side of a two-side story.
Mm.
So, I mean, you have to bear that in mind, and there are two sides to the same story. And I mean, a little anecdote I'll give you. In Monaco in 1988, there's a battle for pole position, surprise, surprise, between Prost and Senna. So Senna went out towards the end and grasped pole position. Happy days, comes in 10 minutes before the end. Alain gets back into his car. And remember, Alain at this time was kind of king of Monte Carlo. Went back out, beat Senna's time. And Alain had a habit of, when he had just set a pole time or an excellent time, he would drive into the pits, undo the seatbelts, stand up in the cockpit of the car. And, of course, the French press were like flies around a cowpat. Couldn't wait to get the word from the man who just established a new pole position. 5 minutes to go, Senna gets back into his car, goes back out, and utterly and totally blitzed Alain Prost's provisional pole time by over a second. I mean, unheard of. And anybody would do that around Monte Carlo. And as soon as the time was announced, all the press that were around Alain Prost just disappeared. They went straight to Senna's pit, to Senna's car. The entire McLaren team couldn't get enough of Ayrton Senna, and you had this poor little Alain Prost, like a little orphan, standing up in his car, nobody loves me. And it was just a moment in time at a Grand Prix. Now, Alain Prost won that Grand Prix because partway through it, Senna, whether he lost concentration or he was distracted, made a rare driving error in a race, hit a barrier, and he was literally out of the race. He went back to his flat in Monte Carlo. He hid there almost for 24 hours. He was so ashamed of what he had done. He had let himself down. He had let his team down. But primarily, it had shown a flaw. He had shown something that he wasn't quite the whole Superman package that he thought he was, and he wanted people to believe.
Listen, fascinating stuff. There's a lovely text in, by the way. Tom says, I have John Watson right up there alongside any of the greats in Irish sports broadcasting. His recall and precision with language is unimpeachable, which is a nice compliment,
John. That's lovely. That's really kind. Thank you.
Listen, it's lovely to talk to you again. Thanks so much. That was fascinating.
Not at all. All right, Joe.
All right, John Watson there.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.